This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Brian Koberger.
Let's try a little thought experiment here, shall we? Sometimes when you take a look at cases from different perspectives, maybe ones that you don't go down the road of much because you're already on the path of this person's guilty or this person's innocent. Sometimes when you take a look at it going, okay, if I were to believe things from this perspective, what would have to be true? That's what we're going to do here today. So if you are to believe Brian Koberger did not commit these crimes that he's alleged to have committed, here's what you'd have to believe. Based on the evidence, based on the data, based on everything that we know so far in this case, there's a lot more that's going to come out. Based on just this, this is what you'd have to believe. Tell me what you think about all this in the comments section on YouTube. If you're listening to our podcast, wherever it may be, press subscribe, whether it's on a podcast platform or YouTube. And please do check out our YouTube channel, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, so you can comment on this and give me your thoughts. So let's begin. Let's talk about that knife sheet that was found lying on the bed. You know, the knife sheet, that thing? Right next to Madison Mogan's body, a standard issue tan leather K-bar knife sheet, military style, stamped with the United States Marine Corps insignia. No knife, just the sheath and the button snap. The part you pop open to draw the blade. It was a single male DNA profile. That right there is the anchor of the case. You want to believe Brian Koberger is innocent? Okay. But to do that, you need to somehow explain away the fact that his DNA was allegedly found on the snap. Not near the scene, not on a doorknob or an item someone could touch in passing, but on the murder weapon accessory, the thing that holds the actual murder weapon, the thing that would take a little bit of effort to pop that snap off, because it's not just like a typical shirt snap. K-bar knife sheath snaps are a little difficult to snap up because it's a knife. So they want to be really sure if you're pushing down on that and pulling that thing up, takes a little effort. That's how you get that much DNA on it. And it was left on a victim's bed in the middle of a quadruple homicide. The literal last thing a killer would want to leave behind. Bearing the literal last thing the killer would want to bear. His DNA. And to be clear, this wasn't some degraded, partial, we might have had a match sample. This was the full single source male profile. When investigators eventually matched it against DNA taken from trash outside Koberger's family home in Pennsylvania, it came back with a likelihood ratio that excluded 99.9998% of the male population. In layman's terms, unless Brian Koberger has a secret identical twin no one's ever heard of, it is his DNA. So what would we have to believe to still think he's innocent? Well, first, we'd have to believe that the real killer just so happened to own or obtain a knife sheath that had Koberger's DNA on it. Maybe Koberger handled it once at a surplus store. Oh, wait, he got it on Amazon directly. Or maybe the killer got his hands on one of Koberger's personal items, wiped it down on the snap, and then placed it at the scene. That's one opinion, sure, but let's be honest. If your theory requires imagining a scenario where a killer went out of his way to get Koberger's DNA and then choose to leave that behind next to a dead body, we're kind of approaching the land of sci-fi. You also need to believe that this all happened without leaving any other physical trace of anyone else at the scene. Because here's the thing. That knife sheath, it didn't have a mix of DNA. It wasn't like a crowded party scene where you'd expect a few stray cells from different people. It had one person's DNA on it. That's it. One person. No second contributor. No partials. Just the guy who's going to be on trial. Now, defense attorneys might, you know, they might argue about DNA transfer. Maybe Koberger's DNA got on the sheath through secondary contact, like someone else touched a surface he'd touched, then touched the sheath. But we're not talking about a stray skin cellar doorknob here. We're talking about the snap closure on a military-style knife sheath allegedly found under a corpse in a locked-off crime scene with nobody else's DNA in sight. If that's a transfer, it's the most precise, surgically accurate case of indirect contact the forensic world has ever seen. And look, DNA can degrade, samples can be messy, but that's what makes this so unusual. This was clean. It was intact. Investigators weren't digging through chaos to find a weak result. It was a gold standard match. Just in case everyone's wondering, no, the police didn't go rummaging around his trash and immediately decide to arrest him. They used a genealogical search to track the DNA to a family line and then narrowed it to Koberger. Then they waited, watched, followed, got DNA from his father's trash in Pennsylvania, compared that to the sheath DNA, then finally got a direct sample from Koberger after his arrest. Three steps, each one confirming the same conclusion. If this was contamination, it would have to be the most consistent contamination in modern criminal history. And if that's not enough, let's add a dog to the mix. A little while after Koberger's arrest, when authorities searched his apartment in Pullman, they collected a long list of items: vacuum debris, fibers, possible hairs, and a strand of animal hair. Now, in most cases, that might be meaningless, but in this case, we know one of the victims, Kaylee Gonzalez, had a dog, and the dog was found alive at the crime scene, reportedly barking during the attack. If that animal hair, pending forensic testing, matches the dog from the house, we have another direct link between Koberger's private apartments and the murder scene. Again, pending investigation, something that'll probably come out in court. Again, if you believe Koberger is innocent, you'd need to believe that a dog hair from the crime scene just casually drifted into his apartment on a breeze, or maybe the real killer borrowed Koberger's clothes and took them for a joyride to the murder and back, or maybe that dog just had a talent for teleportation. Anything's possible, right? And what about the rest of the scene? You'd expect a crime that bloody, that violent, to leave traces everywhere. Blood smears, hair, skin, something, but no one else's DNA is found on the sheath. There's no evidence of multiple people carrying out this crime, no defensive wounds suggesting a team effort, nothing that points to anyone but the person whose DNA was sitting on the combat sheath next to one of the bodies. There were other DNA samples in the house, sure. Some unknown profiles here and there, on a handrail. Another on a glove outside in winter. You're probably going to find a lot of gloves outside in winter on a college campus. But here's the catch. None of those are on the murder weapon or in indirect contact with the victim's body. The glove could have been from a first responder, a college student walking, anything, really. The blood smear could belong to a friend who was there weeks earlier. The college house? For throwing out a murder charge every time a visitor leaves DNA behind, we'd never get a conviction. But that knife sheath, that's different. That's not a place random people touch. It's not something you accidentally drop. It's a part of the murder kit. And Brian Koberger's alleged DNA was on it. So here's where the rubber meets the road again. To believe Brian Koberger is innocent, you'd have to believe a lot. You'd have to believe that someone else committed this crime, brought that very specific kind of knife, and just accidentally or intentionally left the sheath with Koberger's DNA sitting on it right next to the corpse. You'd have to believe that nobody else's DNA showed up on it because the random killer was cleaner than a military surgeon. And you'd have to believe that despite this overwhelming stroke of bad luck, Brian Koberger still just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, with the wrong background, in the wrong car, with the wrong behavior. You'd also have to believe that the Idaho State Lab, the genealogy tracing, the confirmatory trash DNA match, or confirmatory trash DNA match, and the direct swab all lined up to point at the wrong guy. That they all, independently, just happened to screw it up in the exact same way. If this were a movie, we'd call it far-fetched. If it were a book, you'd roll your eyes and toss it across the room. But this isn't fiction. It's a quadruple homicide. And the simplest, most logical explanation is that Brian Koberger was there because his DNA was there on something that no one else should have touched, in a place no one else should have left it. The odds of that happening to an innocent man? Well, they're kind of virtually non-existent. Here's the thing. Brian Koberger's DNA didn't appear in a vacuum. It's not like investigators drew his name out of a hat and then built the case around that one lab result. They watched him. They followed him. They dug into every signal his life was quietly broadcasting while he thought no one was watching. And what they found was that every single breadcrumb, his phone, his car, his timing, aligned with the murder of four students in a way that makes any theory of innocence feel like an improv exercise in denial. Let's start with the phone. Koberger's phone didn't just betray him once. It betrayed him 12 times. 12 different occasions. In the weeks and months leading up to the murders, his phone pinged cell towers that covered the exact area where the victims lived. 1112 King Road in Moscow, Idaho. Not once during the day, not because he had a class there, was organizing pizza in the neighborhood, ordering pizza in the neighborhood. These visits happened late at night or in the early morning hours, over and over. So if you believe he's innocent, you got to start there. You got to believe that for reasons unknown, this 28-year-old PhD student in criminology just happened to take quiet nighttime drives through a college neighborhood where he didn't know anyone, where he wasn't meeting anyone, where he had no social or academic ties, and where four young students would eventually be murdered. And you'd have to believe he did this repeatedly, including one specific night in August where a sheriff's deputy pulled him over just minutes after his phone pinged right near the house. Wrong place, wrong time again. Fast forward to the night of the murders, November 13th, his phone was active until 2:47 a.m., connecting to towers near his apartment in Pullman, Washington. It's about a 15-minute drive from Moscow. Then suddenly, silence. From 2:47 until 4:48 a.m., his phone went dark completely. No signal, no tower connection, no activity, just off. Right as the murders were taking place. Now, if you believe Brian Koberger is innocent, you've got to believe that he randomly turned off his phone for exactly the same two-hour window that the real killer used to carry out one of the most brutal homicides in recent history. Wasn't a dead zone, cell coverage exists the whole route, it wasn't airplane mode for a nap, he was allegedly out driving, and his phone just so happened to be silent through it all. Then, as if on cue, at 4:48 a.m., the phone lights back up. And guess what? It's not pinging in Pullman, where it started. It's pinging south of Moscow, on the same stretch of road. White Hyundai Elantra had just been seen driving away from the crime scene at high speed minutes later. You'd have to believe this was just an accident, a perfect technological fluke. Maybe his phone ran out of battery and came back online in exactly the spot the real killer was fleeing through. Or maybe he left his phone behind with someone else, and someone else drove his car and committed the murders. That's another popular theory, right? And someone else did it in his vehicle while he, what, slept through the whole thing and didn't notice his car was gone? And then this is important. At around 9 a.m. that same morning, his phone pings again in the vicinity of the King Road home. The bodies hadn't been discovered yet. No crime scene tape, no sirens, just a quiet, blood-soaked house no one had entered. According to the data, Koberger's phone was right there again. So now, you're on the hook for two beliefs if you think he's innocent. First, that he coincidentally blacked out his phone at the time of the murders. And second, that he coincidentally wandered by the exact house later that same morning before the police even knew what had happened. Maybe he just liked the neighborhood, or maybe he was sightseeing. But sure, it starts to feel less coincidence and more like compulsion, because if that trip was what it looks like, a return to the scene to see what the fallout was, it matches a psychological profile you'd expect from someone who couldn't help but revisit their own crime. Let's talk about the car. Investigators didn't just track the phone, they tracked movement using video from traffic and residential surveillance cameras all over the area. They pieced together the path of a white sedan that started circling the King Road neighborhood in the early morning hours of November 13th. The vehicle is seen on video at 3:29 a.m., making one pass, then again. By 4:04 a.m., it appears to stop or park near the residence. At 4:20 a.m., it flees the area at high speed, taking a roundabout route out of the neighborhood using back roads, and then it travels south and eventually loops north, mirroring almost identically the path Koberger's phone takes when it comes back online. That car captured on video multiple times, was a white Hyundai Elantra without a front license plate. Now, for those outside of Idaho, here's a detail that might slip past you. Idaho requires front and rear plates. Pennsylvania, where Koberger's car was registered at the time, only requires a rear plate, meaning that car on the video, white Elantra, no front plate, isn't just a match in color and shape, it's a match in legal detail. You're not just finding a similar vehicle, you're finding his vehicle. Eventually, investigators traced the car to Koberger, 2015 white Elantra, registered in Pennsylvania, residing at the Washington State University apartment complex in Pullman, where they pulled campus surveillance. They saw that same car leaving his apartment lot around 2:44 a.m., the night of the murders, and it returned around 5:25 a.m. Let's recap. Koberger's phone stops transmitting at 2:47 a.m. The car leaves his residence at 2:44. The murders occur between 4 and 4:20. The same car is seen fleeing the scene while his phone remains dark. The car returns to Pullman. The phone lights back up. You'd have to believe that someone else, again, just so happened to drive a car identical to his in the exact same direction on the exact same time with no front plate on the night of the murders, and that Koberger himself didn't notice or report that his car had been taken or realize he was about to be linked to the crime scene by moving a constellation of video footage and cell tower data. It doesn't stop there. Phone data, the lack of alternative suspects with anything even remotely resembling this trail, it all piles into a portrait of proximity and opportunity. And yet, for some reason, Koberger has never offered an alibi. There's been no statement of, I was here, I was with someone, just silence. And from the defense team, vague suggestions about unreliable cell data, unidentified DNA on unrelated items. But when it comes to the phone in the car, the silence is loud. I know he said, Ann Taylor said, he likes to go and stargaze. It was a foggy night. You couldn't see. And the judge said, that's not an alibi. Because it's not. The white Elantra was also allegedly observed in multiple states as Koberger drove across the country to Pennsylvania with his father just a few weeks after the murders. During that trip, he was pulled over twice in Indiana. The car matched every detail right down to his make, model, and missing front plate. He didn't ditch it. He didn't paint it. He didn't even try to hide it, which, depending on how you look at it, either signals supreme confidence or total detachment. And remember, after the FBI tracked him down in Pennsylvania, they watched him clean that same car inch by inch in his parents' driveway. Not a casual rinse, not a winter wash, a thorough, gloved, methodical clean. Investigators noted he even went so far as to wear surgical gloves while taking out trash. It's the kind of behavior you'd expect from someone who knows that a single hair, single fiber, single speck of blood in the back seat could close the loop. The car is key. The car is the one thing that connected every piece of the story in motion, and Koberger allegedly treated it like a crime scene, because according to the prosecution, it was. So here's where we are. You got a phone that seems to go to sleep right when the murders begin and wakes up just in time to flee. You've got a car that fits the exact description and legal specifications of the suspect vehicle, following the exact route to and from the crime. You got surveillance footage timestamped and geolocated that draws a near-perfect map of the killer's movements. And somehow in the middle of all of this, you got Brian Koberger, whose phone, whose car, whose timeline all sync up with the evidence like sheet music played by someone who thought no one was listening. To believe he's innocent, you'd have to believe someone else, not him, was driving that car, using that route at that time. You'd have to believe his mystery killer was a ghost driver, a phantom twin who somehow shadowed Koberger's life so precisely that even the digital trail couldn't tell them apart. You'd have to believe in a version of reality where all the evidence just happens to point to him, where the real perpetrator left no trace except the one that looks exactly like Koberger's trace. And if you're still holding on to that theory, then you've got to ask yourself one more thing. If it wasn't Brian Koberger, then why did every piece of evidence in his life, from his car to his phone to his silence, act like it was? Because now we're going to take a look at the man himself, who he was, allegedly, what he studied, and what he did after the murders, and what you'd have to believe about that to keep the illusion of innocence alive. By the time Brian Koberger was arrested, the public didn't know much about him yet. Just a name, a white Elantra, a pair of bushy eyebrows. But as the weeks went by and more details emerged, a picture started to form, not just of the knight in question or the physical evidence left behind, but of the man himself, what he studied, how he thought, and how in the aftermath of a quadruple murder, he acted less like someone shocked to be accused of a heinous crime and more like someone who thought he'd pulled it off. Let's start with the basics, shall we? Brian Koberger was a PhD student in criminology at Washington State University. That alone, not suspicious. Lots of people study criminal behavior. But Koberger wasn't just a student, he was immersed. His academic interest didn't stop at policy or policing methods. He wanted to get inside the mind of people who committed violent crimes, and he wasn't shy about it. In June of 2022, just 5 months before the murders, he posted a survey on Reddit seeking participants for a study. The goal to ask people who had committed crimes how they felt while doing it. Not how they justified it, not what led up to it, but how it felt. The questions included things like, what were you thinking and feeling at the time of the crime? How did you plan it? Did you prepare in advance or act on impulse? In essence, he wasn't just asking about the act. He wanted to understand the experience of committing violence from the inside out. That survey was supposedly tied to his graduate research. It might have been a legitimate project, and well, he was. But if you're trying to explain how someone could be accused of four brutal, planned-out stabbings and that someone happened to have been actively studying how people plan and commit violent acts, it's a hard thing to write off as irrelevant. You'd have to believe that this overlap, his focus on violent behavior and his alleged connection to violent crimes, was just bad timing, pure coincidence. That's not the only red flag in the resume. Koberger also applied for an internship with the Pullman Police Department a few months before the murders. According to court records, he expressed a desire to help law enforcement analyze data and improve public safety in rural areas. It sounds noble on the surface, but when you pair it with everything else, his fascination with violent offenders, his study of the criminal mind, his reported interest in notorious serial killers, the picture starts to shift. He wasn't just studying criminals, he was studying how not to get caught. And maybe how to feel if he was to be one. Because remember, he doesn't seem to have empathy. And that's in his own words, allegedly, if you're to believe the earlier writings that were found online. So now ask yourself, if someone wanted you to commit or wanted to commit a crime and thought they were smart enough to outmaneuver the system, how would they behave? What would they do after the fact? Let's talk about his actions in the weeks following the murders. After November 13th, Koberger didn't run, he didn't vanish, he stuck around, finished out the semester, graded papers, but even then, people noticed something had changed. Students at WSU described him as suddenly more distracted, less strict in his grading, less present. Before the murders, he was known for being intense, overly critical, hyper-focused. Afterwards, he became detached, even aloof. He reported started giving students full marks for weak work. That might not be the behavior of a guilty man unraveling, but it's not what you'd expect from someone continuing life as usual either, especially someone who, if innocent, had no idea his name was even in the mix yet. And then there's the car, the white Hyundai Elantra, the one that had already shown up on police radar thanks to surveillance footage. The same make, model, and year range investigators were asking the public about. Instead of ditching it, Koberger took it on a 2,500-mile road trip back home to Pennsylvania with his father riding shotgun. It wasn't some quiet family Christmas. Investigators now say he was being tracked the entire time. His car was flagged multiple times along the way. And what did he do once he got home? He cleaned it meticulously. According to sources close to the investigation, Koberger was seen scrubbing his Elantra inside and out in the days before his arrest. Not a quick wash, a winter grime removal, an inch-by-inch deep clean, allegedly wearing surgical gloves. That wasn't the only time the gloves came out. He was also reportedly seen late at night wearing those same gloves while taking his family's garbage out, not into their own trash cans, but into the neighbor's trash cans. Now, if you're innocent, this is pretty strange. Gloves to take out the trash using someone else's garbage cans? It's not illegal. It's not even suspicious on its own. But when you're the subject of a major murder investigation and investigators are actively trying to collect your DNA, it's hard not to look at that and see a man trying to keep his biological footprint out of public reach. When the arrest finally came, it was early morning. FBI agents and local law enforcement converged on his parents' home. Koberger was reportedly awake, dressed in black, standing in the kitchen when they came in. And according to law enforcement accounts, the first thing he said was, "Am I the only one being arrested?" Not, "What's going on?" Not, "I didn't do anything." Not, Where's your ward? No, he asked if he was the only one, which, depending on your interpretation, is either the world's most oddly phrased expression of disbelief, or the kind of thing someone says when they're trying to gauge whether their plan fell apart and whether anyone else has flipped. It's not a confession, but it's not helpful either, and it adds to a pattern that brick by brick builds a wall that's hard to climb over. Because at every turn, Koberger behaves like someone who knew exactly what kind of evidence investigators would be looking for, and who tried maybe a little too hard to stay one step ahead. And that brings us to the defense. Since his arrest, Koberger has not offered a public alibi, other than, "I like to look at the stars." No statements he was with someone else that night. No claim that he was asleep or working or out of town. Nothing. His legal team has not contested the DNA evidence. They haven't denied that he drove that car. Instead, they've leaned on questions. Questions about cell phone data, questions about the reliability of video footage, questions about unknown male DNA allegedly found elsewhere in the house. And let's address that. Yes, police did find other DNA at the crime scene, a glove in the snow, and someone else's DNA. There was a blood smear on a railing, possibly other trace material, but none of it was on the victims themselves. None of it was found on the knife sheath. None of it points to a specific alternate suspect. The defense can argue that the presence of unknown DNA in a party house opens the door to doubt. But here's the problem. In a college house with frequent guests, shared living spaces, and overlapping social circles, you'd expect random DNA to show up. The standard isn't whether other DNA just exists. It's whether that DNA is relevant to the murders. And so far, there's no indication it is. What about the sheath? The one with Koberger's DNA on the snap. The defense hasn't challenged that, not publicly, not in court filings yet. They haven't alleged lab contamination, haven't accused the police of planting evidence, haven't pointed to an alternate source. And that silence is deafening, because if you're trying to create reasonable doubt, you'd think that one piece of physical evidence that directly connects your client to the crime scene would be the first thing you attack. Instead, the argument seems to be, we can't prove he was there. There's no eyewitness saying that's him. There's no GPS tag showing him inside the house. There's no blood-covered clothing found in his possession. And sure, those gaps matter, but they leave room to question. But taken together, his phone going dark, his car circling the block, his DNA on the murder sheath, his return to the scene, his silent behavior, his gloves, his trash games, his academic obsession with violent crime, you have to ask, how many separate coincidences does it take before we stop calling it a coincidence? As if Brian Koberger is innocent, then the real killer is a shapeshifter. Someone who not only looks like him, drives like him, and moves like him, but who left his DNA behind. It just happened to match him to. A killer who managed to commit four murders with a military precision, plant evidence in a way that could only incriminate Koberger, and then vanish without leaving any digital or physical trail of their own. That's not an alibi, that's a unicorn. When the best version of innocence you can come up with requires that level of fantasy, when every observable action lines up more cleanly with guilt than with confusion or fear or shock, you have to wonder how long we're going to pretend the facts don't speak for themselves. Because when a man spends his life studying how to commit the perfect crime, and then a near-perfect crime happens in his backyard, and then his phone, his car, his behavior, and his DNA all start humming the same tune, the question isn't why him, it's how could it be anyone else? What do you think? Let me know in the comments section on YouTube. If you're listening to the podcast, please check out our YouTube channel, Hidden Killers with Tony Brewski, and tell me what you think there. Press subscribe wherever you're listening to the podcast, and please hit subscribe on YouTube too, so people know we exist. We do greatly, greatly appreciate that. And like I said, leave the comments there as well. My name is Tony Brewski. Thank you for watching. We will talk again real soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed
in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is,
but
he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.